Hi, I'm Brennan Nugama, the cinematographer of Child's Play, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today, you'll learn all about filming horror with director of photography for the new Child's Play movie, Brendan Nugama. Learn how Brendan shot and lit the robotic Chucky doll, his visual references, and how his work on Riverdale and Chilling Adventures of Sabrina prepared him for Child's Play. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, buy, rent, create at rule.com, Hedge.video, the fastest way to back up media, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Well, we've got a great episode for you guys today. Brendan Nugama. Brendan Nugama, you know him, you love him from Instagram for sure, and of course, all of his great work on Riverdale, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and the new Child's Play movie. We talk all about filming horror, how he lights it, how he shoots it, working with that crazy robotic Chucky doll, all the stuff that you want to know about that film and about horror projects that you may be working on right now or may be working on in the future. There's a lot to learn in this episode, and we thank Brendan for coming on. But before we get to the interview, I want to talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. They've got a fantastic inventory of so many things: cameras, lighting, audio, grip gear, communications, camera dynamics, movies. It goes on and on and on. But of course, you need a great inventory, and they have that. But in addition to the great inventory, they have attentive service. Now, it's not just great service, it's attentive service. And what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that Rule has got your back. They're supporting you. They are committed to your project just as much as you are. Now, I know that sounds kind of crazy, but believe me, you go and you rent some equipment from Rule and you'll feel it. You will feel it. Because before you even leave with your equipment, you're going to get technical guidance before you take the equipment out. And they're committed to your shoot. They're committed to support you while you're on location. And really what that all comes down to is peace of mind. So when you're on set, you're using equipment from Rule. First of all, it's going to be in great condition. You're going to get everything that you want because of their inventory. And you know that if in the slim chance that there's an issue, they've got you back. So it's all there at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. One last thing before we jump into the interview. I want to encourage you to follow our Instagram and Twitter because we are always posting who is upcoming as a guest and asking our audience, you guys, to submit your questions. So it's a great way to get your voice heard on the Go Creative Show. So you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Go Creative Show. Okay, it's time to dive right into the interview. There's so much to learn here with director of photography of the new Child's Play, Brendan Nugama. So I'm here with Brendan Nugama, cinematographer and director of photography for the new 2019 version of Child's Play. Brendan, thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Your work is really, really good. I've been like learning about you over the past couple days, just prepping for the interview, and you have really good work, and it's varied. You do a lot of types of work. And just before we dove in, we had just this little mini conversation about how to like refer to you when I do your intro. And I had said, you know, do you care if it's director of photography or cinematographer? And you seem to not care. Some people do. But then you started diving into just this idea of the distinctions between the two. And I thought it was interesting. So I kind of want to almost start there if you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah. It's teach their own, I guess. And it's, there's not really a one that's right or wrong, but I always just say cinematographer because I like to, I don't know, I really think that I'm hands-on with the camera. I try to operate a lot. I just feel like cinematographer is the term that I associate with the most. But director of photography is just as good. either or works.
And I hear that too a lot, that when people are operating a lot, they'll consider themselves the cinematographer in a weird way. It's like, I think there's something about like really having your hands on that camera that for some reason makes people feel like cinematographer is the term versus director photography. And I think a lot of people are surprised if they're not really in the film and video community, they're surprised to know that sometimes a director of photography doesn't ever touch the camera. And I think that's a surprising thing for people that are not necessarily in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of, it's true. There are a lot of cinematographers or director of photography or cinematographers who don't operate at all. And there's certain jobs and days where I don't, and it makes sense to not. And,
do you like that?
Operating?
Yeah. No, I mean, not operating. Is there something kind of freeing and sort of interesting about, like, does that open you up to focus on different things when you're not operating?
Yeah, I guess in certain ways it does. I mean, you can, if you're multiple cameras, it's sometimes a little nicer to be able to sit back and look at multiple monitors and really see every image and not just the one. That makes a lot of sense. Really big days where there's a lot of, like, you know, is like running around a little bit more, that sort of thing. Sometimes it's nice to have the operator who can kind of just set things up. And if you have just a fantastic operator, who can just make everything, great and better and that sort of thing, then it's always a nice thing. When I started, I was always like operating the camera. That was just part of it. And cinematography, that's kind of where it was about taking photographs of movies. And that was just how I always did it. So,
We recently had Stuart Dryberg on the show, the DP for Men in Black that's coming out this year. And, it was interesting because he operated his own camera for the action scenes. Like that's when he wanted to do it because he felt that he would get a more organic reaction. So he would follow where the action is the way that a person would if they were just in the middle of the scene. And those were the moments where he chose to, put the camera handheld and just get right in there and get his hands on it. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that works. Everything, the thing is like everything works. It's all subjective. Certain days that's the right approach. And other days you might feel like, based on whatever the elements are in front of you or the moments that are coming up that you decide it's better not to. And it could be, another action day where it just doesn't feel right. You just kind of roll with what your gut says and go for it.
This new Child's Play looks really great. You must be very proud of it.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
You look at the trailer and it's reminiscent of the franchise, but it also has a newness to it. Like it has something that just feels more modern. Of course, the storyline is more modern, obviously, because you're involving new technologies and things like that. But it's just a fun project to be involved with, I can imagine. It's always had, Child's Play has always sort of had a little bit of tongue-in-cheek humor in it, even in its darkest points. Did you feel the same way when you got involved in this project?
Yeah, totally. The script is a really well-written, strong script.
Yeah.
Had a lot of I wouldn't say it had a comedy, but it had a lot of light moments that were taking fun with what it was. But at the same time, it was it's a horror and it's keeping with the franchise and that sort of thing. But it was when Lars, the director, and I would sit down and talk in the early days of prep, it was really finding that balance of when to kind of get into keeping it a little lighter or keep it a little darker and scarier. And, there was a big arc in the story for Lars that was very important. That was really about Andy, the kid who gets the doll, and becoming really good friends with the doll. And it's kind of that like E.T., Alien and Elliot kind of relationship building where they just like, they become best friends and then, but in our version, Chucky goes bad.
Yes. Yeah. He certainly does. And in your version, Chucky goes bad in a bunch of different ways. Like just the way that the company that created Chucky also creates all these other like in-home, Internet of Things type of devices, you're able to play with destruction across a whole bunch of different areas.
Yeah. Well, so it's very smart because, the original Child's Play is based on voodoo, right? It's a serial killer who gets trapped in a ball, who puts himself into the doll. And our version is AI, and it's a doll who, by hanging out with Andy and seeing him and his friends and what they're into and laughing at and that sort of thing, you know, watching horror films and thinking it's funny. And he learns kind of the bad sort of side of things. And he thinks that to make them laugh, he can do these things, and which is part of it. And then it's kind of taking a play into what, you know, like a Google Home or Alexa would be, where it can connect to all your devices that are based on that. And Chucky is kind of the hub of that. He can connect to everything and control them. So, yeah, a lot of bad things can happen.
So this is the latest installment in the Chucky franchise, the Child's Play franchise. Can you tell me a little bit about what inspired the look? Were you going back to previous movies to inspire the new look?
Not necessarily for the cinematography. I mean, we looked, obviously I rewatched the original Child's Play and had, you know, seen it when I was a kid, but as far as like the lighting and the camera work and the cinematography, we didn't really pull references from the original film. But as far as what went in front of it with Chucky, of course we did. You know, we tested different colors and we wanted to make sure that we kept him looking like an updated version of the original doll, but, you know, keeping with the color palette of his shirt and his overalls and that sort of thing. And
yeah.
So there are little things that went into it, but it was really, we didn't think of trying to pay homage to the original film as far as the style or anything like that. That all just kind of came from conversations, came from the script, came from, you know, just doing what felt like it was the right thing to do for it.
What were your references?
A lot in different ways for different parts, I think. You know, we looked at E.T. quite a bit. We looked at other horror films just to kind of look at kind of, you know, the darkness of it and how to kind of, you know, the horror elements and to make it, you know, what they were doing to make it work for them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think mostly like what I like to do is I watch a lot of stuff when I'm in prep of a show, and it doesn't always have to be in direct reference to that one particular movie. Like it doesn't have to be a horror just because I'm watching that. It could just be movies I like or made by directors I really like or cinematographers I really like. Just to kind of be inspired, you know, like just to be inspired by what these other filmmakers are doing. And you know, it's not that I pull direct references, but it influences me just on a more artistic level of filmmaking, you know, and really liking it.
Yeah. I think something that's interesting about what you have to do with Child's Play and really any horror film that has that little touch of comedy in it or that little touch of lightness in it is that balance between the two has got to be difficult, because if you're really trying to scare someone and they laugh, that could be a horrible reaction to what you're trying to do. Were there discussions ahead of time on like how to get that humor, but also get the fear in there at the same time?
Not really. I mean, like we would talk ahead of time about, like, you know, just telling the story, really, like just telling what, taking the script and the scenes that were in the script and translating it into images that would work. If the script had moments that read funny, you know, we would hope to make sure that those beats were being hit.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't, we would kind of, you know, we'd talk about it, make sure that it did. It wasn't like there was a direct approach as far as like the lighting or the camera work to do that, unless it was an evolution of story where we wanted to reveal something eventually or something along those lines. But, you know, we kind of set our look and we kind of just kept with it. And really just what I've always done is really just go by your gut and what feels right. And the comical elements in the movie are apparent based on what happens. You know, the actors would pull them out really well, or the script would really dictate it. And they were there. We didn't have to kind of like try to make the audience feel that we were trying to tell a joke or make it a light moment.
Do you ever change the way that you shoot or light when you're dealing with child actors? You've had a lot of experience with them. I mean, in Child's Play, certainly, and also Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, you've worked with a lot of young kids, you know, young teens and children too. Does that ever change the way that you shoot and light them?
Definitely changes the way that you shoot. Like Child's Play, we had, you know, because Gabriel Bateman, who played Andy, was young, where we had 10 hours with him. Was it 8 hours? And we had so limited time throughout our day to get all the work done, but our days are built longer. You know, we had 12 to 13 hour days. So we had to shoot Gabriel out as much as we could. Mm. You know, so we would set up our scenes, we would shoot his direction, we would, you know, turn around, complete scenes when as much as possible. But there were days where we had to, you know, shoot Gabriel, move into another scene, shoot his portion of that scene, wrap him, turn back around, complete that scene, go back to the previous scene, complete it with stand-ins and that, or body doubles, photo wow. doubles. And it was definitely, you know, a challenge. And we knew it going in that, you know, it was going to be a challenge with children. There were a lot of he has, you know, two good friends in the movie, and there's more. Actually, there's three good friends and other kids in the film. So it's a lot of children and adult actors. So it was definitely a scheduling thing, but we knew it going in and we were prepared for it. But, you know, they say there's always a thing is like, you know, shooting with children, shooting with animals.
Yeah.
Those are things that make it a little slower and a little more difficult. Well, we had children and animals, and we also had a robotic doll, which was its own challenge. It was a little different, but yeah. So, I mean, you know, we definitely had to alter our approach from how you would conventionally shoot a scene if there were no limitations like that. But, you know, the principles are still there. It was just kind of the order that we had to mess around with a bit.
What about lighting? Does lighting change at all when you're working with young kids?
I don't think so. I think it was, you know, the lighting would change based on what the story is and what the show is and what the, you know, what the look of that show is. I would keep it in that world of whatever, you know, it should be. I don't think there was any kind of like specialty approaches for them in particular, just because they were children. It was more, you know, we'd find the light for that show and stick with it. So, I mean, Child's Play had its own color palette that I think was a little different from, you know, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina and other shows. And I would just make sure that was maintained the best that we could.
Well, something I wanted to talk to you about is color palette, because looking at your work, I mean, Riverdale, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and Child's Play, and you've done certainly a whole bunch of other things, but you seem to have a really strong color palette in all of your pieces. There, it's defined. It's clear. Like, you really can feel the color. It seems like something that is translating through all of your work, and I don't know if you're conscious of it or not, but it seems like it's something that you really find important.
Yeah, I do. I find color contrast to be a very important thing. You know, like there's light and shadow contrast. You know, you get a key light and falls off on their face to dark shadows or throughout the room, and that is important. It makes your images a little bolder and whatever, and it can, you know, you can isolate where you want the audience to look based on that, but you can also do that with color. And by contrasting colors, you know, you get really rich images, and I've just always liked that. You know, I've always liked rich color contrasting shots and images. And I've, you know, certain shows you don't always do it. I've done shows before as well where it's very monochromatic, and that's the right way to do it. But, you know, for Riverdale, for example, it was, you know, based on comic book franchise, and we really wanted to play that and heighten that and bring those colors out. And Sabrina had its own palette that was a little different, but same idea. We wanted to kind of play with colors and again with Child's Play. So it is something that I think is, I find I'm often looking at is how to tell the story with color as well.
And when you do that, I mean, a lot of the colors obviously coming from the set design and the wardrobe. Are you going ahead of time and working with those departments to make sure that your color palette is realized?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, Child's Play, we did a lot a lot of talking with our production designer, and we would test tons of different things as far as the, you know, the paint colors of the walls, the wallpaper, the wardrobe, you know, even the colors of certain props and different things that they would use, and make sure that it worked with us. And it was like something that we found visual and strong and would, you know, work for our story. And then I would do the same thing with my lighting. I would, you know, pick color gels. We did a test day of just color for gels and what the night colors would be and the day colors would be, and tested, you know, 10 different variations of blues and oranges and greens and whatnot, and found our color palette. And same with the other shows. I really try to make sure that it says like intertwined, because if you try to do it all with the lighting only and color balance on your camera or whatever, it's great, but it's not as, you know, if you had art department involved in it, how much better it would be.
That sounds so great. Like just having the time to do all these test days sounds like such a fantastic luxury. I mean, I do a lot of commercial work. It's so fast. You don't get a lot of time to do these preps. And, you know, I love talking to DPs that have time to actually do that. And it really makes a difference to be able to sit there and make sure that everything that's going in front of the camera is exactly what should be there. Talk to me a little bit more about the prep for Child's Play. How much time do you usually have? Just roughly, how many days are usually spent in the prep period where you're figuring out what camera package you're using, what your color palette is, all that kind of stuff?
Well, Child's Play, my first day of prep on Child's Play was 7 weeks. Well, yeah, I was hired on with 7 weeks out of principal photography, but then we actually pushed a week, so I ended up with 8 weeks.
Hmm.
So that, you know, that was great. That was, a great amount of time, a luxurious amount of time in many ways, but it was appropriate, you know, like it was needed. There was a lot involved with the show because of, you know, just figuring out how to work with this doll and how to photograph the doll. And, you know, that was like, of course, with everybody's main concern. I mean, he's our, you know, it's all about Chucky, and he's got to work right, and he's got to look great, and be represented properly for the franchise and for the fans. So MGM, the studio, was very, you know, they wanted to make sure it was done great and done well. Prep was 8 weeks of working from the very beginning, where I would sit down with Lars and everybody in the office, and we would just kind of go through the script many times based on different conversations of what it should be, what that meeting was about, and try and streamline everything as much as we could. I mean, the best way to do it is, you know, fix it in post or fix it in prep, not in post.
Yeah. So I like that.
You try to get all your concerns figured out right away. I mean, everything, there's always things that come up on the day, of course, but the more prepped you are, the easier you can react and adjust on the day.
So I just got a demo on, the program is called Post Lab, and I just got a demo on it a couple of days. It is incredible. For all you Final Cut Pro 10 editors, what Post Lab does is it allows teams of editors to collaborate in Final Cut Pro 10. Now that's been a sore spot for Final Cut for a while. I mean, there are ways to collaborate. We do it all the time, but the perception out there is that you can't really do it, blah, blah, blah. Yes, you can. So let's put that aside. But regardless, what this does is it really makes the collaboration process in Final Cut seamless. Like, this is easy when you use Post Lab. So I'm absolutely blown away by what Post Lab can do. The reason I bring it up is they're not a new sponsor, but Hedge, our current sponsor, they just acquired them. So I'm like all about Post Lab right now, and it's because of Hedge. Now, Hedge is the backup software for filmmakers that I talk about all the time. It, you know, it's super fast. It keeps everything organized with transfer logs. You can import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations all at the same time. So when you're on set, you can have all your media cards imported, and you can set however many hard drives you want on export, click transfer, and it just goes. It's just incredible. Now, what Hedge does for backup softwares is they're all about simplifying. They're about giving you a ton of options, but simplifying the process. PostLab does the same thing. And I think that this collaboration between the two is really going to be exciting. So that's what I'm here today to talk to you guys about. I think PostLab is great and you should check it out. Of course, you obviously should be checking out Hedge over at hedge.video/gocreativeshow. When you purchase a full license, you get 20% off simply by typing Go Creative Show into the coupon code at checkout. So this is a little ad about both. Why not? It's Hedge and it's also PostLab. Check them both out. You'll love them. And lastly, before we get back to the interview, I want to talk about Magnanimous Rentals. Now, Magnanimous is a rental house based in Chicago, but they ship anywhere in the country. So anywhere you are, you don't have to worry. I've rented from them a bunch of times and they just send stuff right to my door. It's fantastic. Now, they've got a great inventory, but where Magnanimous Rentals really shines is their pricing. They are obsessed with having the lowest and best price in the industry. To be honest with you, they have it. They just do. They've got three different pricing tiers. Their regular price is always going to be great, so you don't have to worry. But then they have these things called their dynamic prices. They're on their website in blue, and you'll know they're dynamic because they're blue. And what they do is they auto-lower below the regular price, and they change every day. So you can be sure that you're getting the best price available. But the thing that's the most exciting is what they have. It's called flash discounts. Now, these are in red, and they're right there on their homepage. And what's so great about these are steeply, steeply discounted items. Here's an example. I'm going to their site right now. They've got, they have over 10 items right now on flash discounts. That's incredible. And right there on their homepage, a red Epic W8K, that camera, right? You can rent it for 3 days for under $400. That is insane. It's absolutely insane. So you've got to go to MagRents every day and check out what they have for flash discounts. Now, they're limited time offers. They're steeply discounted, but limited time. And you have to place your order while the flash discount is in effect. So those are the things you need to know. But the best thing to do is go to magrents.com every day and check out their prices. Magrents.com. Let's talk about the actual Chucky doll. You just mentioned a lot of time and effort went into making sure that it was represented correctly. Tell me about how you're creating this doll visually.
There's a company called Masters Effects who built the doll. Mm-hmm. And he's a 100% a robot. And he... We had a couple dolls. We had one that was a full AI or a full robot where you have multiple operators who would work him with remote controls. One would kind of pan his head back and forth. Someone else would be able to control his facial expressions. Someone else could control his arms. And then we had other dolls that were more poseable, that weren't all the robots that looked great, where he wasn't really moving around or anything like that, where he's just kind of there in the shot, which we could use instead. I would imagine it was around 2 months working on just building the doll, getting them right. So it was a lot of work for them, and we would come in, Lars and I and the producers and everybody else would come in throughout prep and throughout the construction of Chucky and look at him and see what the progress was and what we were hoping it could do or look and... how we could change it or help evolve it. And they would kind of go off and do what they needed to do.
Thinking in terms of lighting, the way that the light is going to be reflected off the skin of this doll, like how are you changing or how are you adapting your lighting and shooting, frankly, to make this doll feel big and imposing?
Well, at times you kind of wanted him to feel the opposite. You wanted him to feel like a small little innocent doll.
Yeah, yeah.
That could do these horrible things, you know? So it was more of a surprise when he would do these horrible things, I should say. And, you know, so you kind of treated him like a doll. You know, we would make him feel smaller and hope that we could get innocent looking facial expressions from him and make him just look like this little thing that was kind of cute, you know, that Andy would like, and the kid character would like, and all these other kids in the story that would, you know, be wanting this buddy doll. But the lighting was you know, I guess for Chucky, I found it would work based on his material. It would work better with nice soft light most of the time on his face, but try to keep it contrasty, you know, when we needed. He worked, like, the skin tone of him was very, was good. It was a very kind of natural-ish in a way where he could take a lot of different colored lights and it looked great. You know, he looked the way that it should. And I guess I didn't really give him a, I didn't really give him a Chucky lighting, a certain light that I would use on him all the time. And, but I kind of just kept him soft or shadowy or silhouetted or, you know, blue or warm based on what it was. But, we definitely took a lot of care into making sure every time we looked at him in the frame, it felt right. And if we needed to adjust something, we would.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at the making of featurette that's, you know, that's on, that's out there.
Yeah.
You sort of see that sort of the nice looking Happy Buddy doll is, lit softly and you know, the facial expressions are soft and everything is friendly. But then we get into that, you know, that evil buddy and it's, everything is sort of super contrasty and it's dark and his eyes are glowing and,
And of course,
the facial expression plays a lot into that too. But I think a lot of the work that you were doing, the lighting to make him demonic, is really carrying through.
Yeah. Well, good. Thanks. I mean, like, we would try, we would do it all based on what the scene, you know, called for, as far as like if it's supposed to be a darker, scarier moment or if he's being evil at that time, that would just kind of tell us how to do it.
Yeah.
You know, it would, like, it wasn't really a conversation of, oh, how are we going to make him look here? Should he have more shadows? Just that's what the story called for and that's how it would get represented. So yeah, he would often end up a lot more shadowy or harder lighting and that sort of thing. And there were a lot of times where the eyes glowing, we knew that what they would bring to the image in post. Mm-hmm. So we knew we could get away with keeping him a little more silhouetted or a little more darker and that sort of thing, knowing that those eyes are really going to pop and what that would tell the audience, you know, that it's a little more of a sinister moment.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would definitely be something where we would think about like how it would all translate throughout. And, you know, we never saw because the eyes were obviously visual effects. Those were the only thing that we really relied on from the very beginning of being a visual effect with Chucky was the eyes.
What did you shoot on?
We shot on Alexa minis, with Sumilux lenses, mm-hmm. Leica Sumilux lenses.
How did you come to that decision?
I love the Sumilux lenses. They've been kind of my main, I use them a lot when I shoot spherical. And, there was early talk. We were talking about doing anamorphic. We knew we wanted to shoot widescreen, you know, 2.4.0. So anamorphic was an early conversation. And as soon as we kind of nixed that and decided that spherical was the way to go based on multiple things, including post, it was kind of just an obvious choice for me because I know them so well. I like them. They're great. They're just solid lenses all the way through.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I love playing around with old lenses at times, but this just wasn't the show for that.
Did you do any customization to them at all? I'm hearing a lot more about that. Like a lot of DPs are coming on and saying, you know, they got not necessarily custom lenses, but they got lenses that have, you know, have been tuned, not just for their film, but just in general, just like little tweaks to give you something different.
Yeah, no, we didn't do that for this. We kept them clean. Yeah. I mean, I've done that for lots of other shows and there's times where it works and times where, you know, the thing with Child's Play to me was with, and picking those lenses is I knew the lenses, I knew them inside and out. I've worked with them for years.
Yeah.
Worked with them on Riverdale and other shows, and I knew the color of them, I knew the contrast of them, that sort of thing. So it just it was like second nature. It was natural. You know, I knew what a light would kind of do to it when, or where, if I was at a 2-stop, what it would look like next to a, you know, a 4-stop or whatever. I trusted them, I guess. Yeah.
Did you test any other cameras?
I did. I tested the Sony Venice, which was great. We tested the LF. We were at one point, we were going to go with large format. So we tested those. But yeah, ultimately we decided to go with the minis.
The Alexa LF. I'm sorry. Yeah. They released the mini LF this.
Yeah. Coming out soon.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming out soon. But yeah, this was the large. Yeah. This was the large, Alexa LF that we tested briefly, and it was, you know, they're great cameras. They look fantastic, but, again, it just came down to, you know, all these decisions kind of formed it, and we decided to go with the minis.
Well, what were your thoughts on the Sony Venice?
I think a lot of people are using it. Yeah. I know a lot of guys using it on movies and TV shows. It's a very popular camera right now. And yeah. I work with Kezel Camera quite a bit, and primarily, and they, you know, they're telling me they can't keep them on the shelf kind of thing. You know, always out. Yeah. So yeah, they're great. As far as I could tell, my tests were not, I haven't put it through the works really, you know, I haven't taken it out onto the field and really tested it through multiple conditions. So I don't really have a great opinion of it in that sense. I just, I know that for what we were doing on Child's Play, it just wasn't going to be the right camera for us. It's a big camera as well. It's a little bigger.
Yeah. If you're going with a mini, I mean, the size is going to play a huge factor. What else are you looking for in a camera package for Child's Play? Like, what were the essentials for you? Was it just size or, you know, anything else?
No, it wasn't really based on the size. It was based on, I mean, the Alexa has such a beautiful image. I mean, I know it, I trust it, I love it. And lots of other cameras look great as well. I've worked with Red cameras lots and other cameras, but, you know, the Alexa is beautiful, and the idea of the mini to me next to like an XT or whatever, it's just, it's smaller, but it can do more. Yeah. And so for me, it works. And I like, especially when I'm operating, I like small cameras. I don't like it to be too bulky, too big, you know, I like to just streamline everything and make it, you know, nimble, I guess.
Yeah,
I like when I did the first time I did Riverdale, we were using two. We had a mini and we had an XT. And then the second season when we came back, we were just minis all around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many cameras did you have going for Child's Play?
Two. Yeah. At times we brought out three. For our big days, like we had our big, you know, the end sequences, we bring out three cameras at times, and often working just one camera though. I mean, even though we had two a lot, I'd say half the time it was just one camera working.
Do you prefer that?
I mean, there's times where you need both, where it makes more sense and you would never want to just have one. But for 90% of the work, when it's kind of just a little more intimate and interior, character driven scenes, I love to have one. But if it's an emotional scene or, you know, something where you don't want the actors doing the performance multiple times, two cameras makes a lot of sense. Or if it's a big action sequence where there's stunts and that sort of thing, you want multiple cameras so you don't have to have the stunt performers falling more times than they need to, and that sort of thing. Yeah,
I can assume too, with working with kids, having to move quickly, only having so much time on set with them, it's probably nice to have that second camera.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I want to take a couple minutes and talk about your lighting philosophy on Child's Play, but also it might be something you employ on all your other shoots as well. Is there something that you bring to your lighting philosophy that's unique, or what's your approach?
I think my approach is really I try to make it dictated by every show.
Yeah.
You know, I try to make it dictated by every script and scene you know, I don't think I try to not default to the same thing. But, you know, I think locations really dictate how something should be lit. You know, it's really if you're on location, not on a stage, you know, it kind of tells you where lights have to come from and that sort of thing. And then it's really, to me, it's really the balance of quality of light. Then it's like, then it comes down to, is it hard light or soft light? Is it cool light or warm light? Is it, you know, does it feel harsh? Is it frontal or contrasty? You know, do you want it to be romantic or not? That kind of thing. Mm. And that's all that comes out of the script. And that's all based. And even in the same movie, you can have multiple looks based just on what the scene's about. So my philosophy is just trying to really be truthful to it, you know, really try to make it organic each time and just tell the story the best it can be told.
I wanted to talk for a couple minutes about Sabrina. When you're dealing with a subject matter like witchcraft, people don't necessarily know a lot about it, but they have assumptions about it because they've seen other movies and they may see other TV shows that incorporate it. But I think you did something different with Sabrina where you touched upon things that were familiar but brought something new to it. And I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on how you approached that series and those moments within it.
I guess the main thing we did with that was with witchcraft in particular was that we had the set of old lenses, and this back to the detune thing, actually Panavision took a set of old ultra speed gold lenses and they detuned the hell out of them and became a very distinct crazy look that was very specific. And they basically made those lenses, there's only three sets of those lenses in Panavision inventory. We took two of them and they became very warpy and had very specific characteristics that no other lens would have. And we used those for witchcraft. And that was kind of the idea. It's like when it became witchy or something, you know, satanic, so to speak, or with this script, that was when we used them. That's when we employed them. And the rest of the time, our regular lenses were Panavisions. And they were old lenses, but they were not nearly as crazy as that.
Yeah, because you had to separate the two worlds. I mean, Sabrina had her human world, and then she had her witch world. And,
it wasn't always when it was in her witch world. Like, if she was just in her, in the academy, there, we weren't using them. It was more like when they were doing spells or, the devil was there and that kind of thing. That's when we would really bring them out. Yeah.
Well, it gives it a very unique look. And, it's one of those things where it's like, I always like knowing that stuff like that's being done in camera. Like, that is appealing to me instead of just relying on post to do it. But it's a commitment. I mean, you're sticking to it. You can't really change much after you get into it. So there's got to be a lot of trust in the gear and a lot of trust in you. And it seems like it would be a little bit scary almost.
Yeah. I mean, for the pilot of Sabrina was, like Lee Krager and David Landsberg, Lee's the director, and they spent, those are very specific. It was all about like testing them, changing them, testing them, changing them, testing them, changing them, until we got to this place where they had gone through multiple tuning sessions really to get them to where they were. So when I, came in there, it was fun. I mean, I didn't think that it was scary in any means. I think you have to really push those boundaries really make sure that that's, just trust it and go with it, because it's the only way to push those boundaries. And we were lucky on that show because, Netflix was great and our showrunner was fantastic and very encouraging of that kind of work and, pushing those boundaries. So. It never felt like a thing that was, scary. It felt good.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called Simple Life by Robert Muner. I actually just got this song for a project just last week. I went to PremiumBeat.com. I checked out their collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks. Looked around, found a few that I liked, sent it to the client. They loved it. It fit the project perfectly. And the best part, it was only $49. $49! And I didn't just get this song just in and of itself. No, I got cutdowns, I got loop sets, I got stems. So I was able to customize the track to fit my project perfectly. So that's what you get over at Premium Beat. You get the ability to customize your track. You get all of those extra assets. You get a huge selection of great songs, and all for $49 a song. It's insane. So head over there, premiumbeat.com. And lastly, let's talk about Shutterstock.com. I do something a little bit unusual with Shutterstock.com. Of course, you go there because they've got royalty-free video clips and photos and music and all sorts of stuff. In fact, they have over 14 million royalty-free video clips right now. Many of them are in 4K, which is great for all of us 4K people. But I do something a little bit different. I actually use them in addition to just, you know, the traditional way, getting stock footage and photos. I use them to build my director's reels. My director's treatments. Oh my God, my reels. I would never do that. I use them as my director's treatments. So what I do is like, I actually just won a job last week by using Shutterstock imagery to help me illustrate the vision that I had. So we were doing something we were going to be shooting in an office, and I wanted to get some interesting shots of offices just to kind of show them the type of cinematography we want to go for. And I went to Shutterstock.com. I clicked on footage. There was a curated collection already there called Business. So I quickly searched through there, and I found really beautiful, beautiful shots. So I bought a whole bunch of them. I put them into a little video, and that was what I used as my director's treatment. It sold. You know, it sold me. It sold the vision, and I got the job from it. So it can be used in a whole bunch of different ways. Like, don't just think about it as a stock footage site. You got to think about what those images can do for you, even beyond the borders of video production. So that's what I encourage you to do this week over at Shutterstock.com. Check it out. Get inspired. Use it to illustrate your vision to your clients. And it's all there at Shutterstock.com. All right, we've got so much more interview to go, and there is no reason to wait, so let's dive right in. I want to talk about Riverdale for a moment because you won a Leo Award for Best Cinematography. So it's a 2018 Leo Award for Best Cinematography in a Dramatic Series for Riverdale. Describe the look that you created for that show.
Yeah. Riverdale, I came on season two. And when I started there, I was working with Rob Sidinglass, was the director of that series premiere or season premiere. And we talked a lot about the look and what we wanted the show to be and moving forward with the show throughout the season that I was going to be there. And we both looked at comics and the old comic books of Archie, and there's like the Archie universe is huge. There's like so many variations, including like Archie versus Predator and Archie and Zombies and things like that.
Oh, wow.
So we were looking at those comics.
I didn't know it went that deep.
It goes, yeah, there's a lot of them. It goes deep and it goes off in multiple directions. And so we were looking at these comics and looking at, especially those ones, and looking at what kind of the palettes were that they were using in the drawings. And they were bold, you know, they were strong. They were like a bright red room that was completely lit red. And then a character would walk in front of it and there'd be a blue room in front of him or next to him and sidelight him with blue. And they were doing really cool things like that. And we were like, well, what if we kind of, you know, played with this a little bit for Riverdale and made this show a little more like that? Specifically certain scenes in that first episode. And that's kind of what started it for us. And we just kept going, you know, and making it, as much of a, what I would call like a neon noir, you know, it was like a film noirish with crazy neon-y contrasting colors.
Yeah. That's it. That's an interesting way to put it. Neon noir. I like that. I think that, and that really does describe it because you have a lot of hits of like a tealish green in there that I'm seeing quite a bit. There's reds in there, there's blues in there. And it's interesting because it's super, super saturated, but it also is dark. And that's an interesting balance to achieve.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our moonlight for that started with like a cyan. I think it was a cyan 60 or 90 or yeah, somewhere around a 60 we would start with. And and it was really, you know, greeny blue, and that kind of became our look. And at times I would add a little more cyan to make it even a little richer and deeper, getting it up to like 150 at times based on just putting a 90 and a 60 on top of each other. And it was on top of HMIs, and it would, you know, create, and that became kind of established as what our moonlight was. So now when we're inside, we can, or outside, we can start to contrast that with other bright colors like reds and different things, like especially when they're at Pops Diner, where you have the majority of the set built with neons, and we can play with, really play with that and accentuate it. And that was something we took through all the sets and all the, you know, all the scenes, just that idea of just kind of letting it be what felt right and not necessarily keeping with reality, so to speak.
Were you using like RGB Asteras or Quasars or anything like that? Is that where you were getting your neons from?
No, we weren't using those. On Pop's Diner, we were using neons. We actually had a lot of neon lights. Off camera, we would bring in LEDs, light mats, and different things that we would put color on, or RGB ones, of course, and just change the color. But we didn't have the Asteras on that, on season two of that. But I mean, you know, like I still, season two, I love LED lighting. I use it a lot. I use light mats a ton.
Yeah.
I still really love tungsten light. You know, I still really like a good old fashioned tungsten light. I find it to be the nicest, warmest quality light when it comes to lighting actors. And I'd still try to do it kind of old school that way a lot of the time, just to kind of get the quality there. Nothing to me looks as pleasing on an actor as well, you know, nicely bounced or whatever tungsten light that just is hidden, brought in at the right angle and working for the actor. It looks great.
I agree with you. It's tough to shoot and travel with them. They're heavy, they're hot.
Yeah.
You know, they are outdated in a lot of different ways, but like you shoot an LED for a long time and then you go back and you're like, damn it, it really is better. It just is.
Yeah. I mean, like LEDs are coming really far. Definitely.
Yeah.
I was just at CineGear on the weekend and there was a lot of great products out there that are just phenomenal. And those are the LED lighting is the lighting, right? Obviously, because it's the newest and always changing and evolving, but that's exciting. You know, being able to take these little lights and put them in places and get the amount of light that you get out of them, like the punch that you get is just fantastic. Yeah.
Do you see anything at CineGear that really got you psyched?
You know, to be honest, the thing that got me the most psyched wasn't even lighting wise. I'm really looking forward to I love this Panavision crystal ND, variable ND.
Ah.
They have where you can, you know, just roll through the ND with your iris rather than, or without the iris rather than doing a stop change. You can just do it with the ND and then you can maintain your stop, which maintains your depth of field. Because I'm always finding that I will always have a handset at the monitors and I will always be rolling through focus or through iris rather.
Yeah.
You know, if the character goes from one room to the other, or goes from inside to out or close, you know, from near a window to the opposite side of the room, got to maintain it. And so the depth of field is always changing. So with this, you could actually just keep it the same and not really play around with that. Which is great.
So you're adjusting your variable ND rather than adjusting your iris.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't know how familiar you are with that Sony FS5, but they have like a variable ND, like kind of built in to the camera and a little wheel that, you know, the wheel can control a few different things, but you can set it to control your variable ND, which is awesome because like you said, you can set your iris, set your ISO, you don't have to touch it and you can go inside, outside, anywhere and the depth of field stays the same. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. But you know, do you see a shift in that at all? Like does it bump? Is it from 3 to 6 or is it gradual the whole way through?
It's gradual.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks really good. I mean, for consumer, I'm sure what you're talking about paired with a really super professional camera is going to give you a better look, obviously. But for a consumer camera to have a little feature like that It's really interesting, and it's been in there for a while.
Yeah. Well, this is like a liquid crystal one. So it's actually like an electronically charged filter. So they have, so you could control it. You power it. It has to be powered. And you can control it, and the liquid crystals inside will activate to kind of create the ND.
That's got to look so good.
Yeah. Well, the idea is that it just looks natural. You know, you don't see it, but yeah, it's the idea of it is great. Yeah. I think you get 6 stops on them.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've never been to CineGear. I go to NAB, and you know, we cover CineGear with the guys from newsshooter.com, but never been, but it seems like a really fun show to go to. It's very targeted. It's like just for cinematography and like really high-end Hollywood stuff. I mean, smaller budget things, I'm sure, are going there for interest too, but NAB gets watered down a little bit with so much other stuff.
I've never been to NAB. It was actually my first time to CineGear as well.
Oh, what'd you think?
It was fun. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
But I think it's more cinematographer friendly in a way. Not that NAB is not friendly, but it's like, you know, it's in LA, it's in a back lot. It's just the whole setting is just more conducive to working Hollywood cinematographers.
Well, from what I hear, NAB is just huge. You
it's
know,
insanity.
It takes forever to walk around. And this is, it's small. It's all on the Paramount lot. So you can check everything out really quickly. You can just kind of walk through and you're from one side to the other in, you know, no time kind of thing. So in that sense, it was great, you know. But,
In our last couple of minutes, I want to talk about advice for cinematographers, for people that want to get into this industry. You know, just kind of thinking back to how you made the jump into doing professional work, how you made the jump into doing feature films and big TV shows. When you look back to when you first started, what kind of advice would you give to people that are in that position, trying to get their first big gig and really make it work for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a question that I'm asked a lot. And everybody's asked a lot, you know, it's probably one of the main questions cinematographers get asked. And it's like, you know, everything, I think everybody has their own path and everything happens differently for everybody else. So like, there's no one real answer to get that you can tell someone to get their next big gig and make that big jump. But I do believe that, you definitely have to obviously work hard and always try to, you know, evolve as a cinematographer and shoot a lot. My main thing would be telling them to shoot, you know, get out there and shoot, try different things, try new equipment, new toys, but really, you know, use them for the right reasons and understand how they can tell a story better. And really just like trying to learn and own your craft kind of thing, you know, and like really just getting out there as much as you can, meeting different people. But it's you know, there's no one answer that can really set that off.
Well, you did an article with Mandy.com and I thought it was interesting in your sort of answer to this question. You know, you talked about challenging yourself. You also talked about sort of mastering the technical so that you can focus on what's important, the storytelling.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. I thought that was an interesting take on it. So do you feel like you did that for yourself? Like earlier in your career, you just focused on the technical.
I don't think I focused on it in that sense. I don't think that was my mindset going into different jobs, but until you really know it, until the technical is not something you have to be thinking about too heavily or worried about and that sort of thing. Once you master the technical side, then you can really use those tools to be creative.
Yeah.
And you don't have to think about it in the same way. That's, I think what I meant by that is just once you're, you know, you can be set free of the technical side. Like the whole idea of, you know, what camera you're shooting and, you know, what resolution is it at, or is it film or digital? And, you know, those things don't matter. That's really what it is. It's like, those things aren't important. You got to know them. You have to know them really well so you don't make mistakes with them. You have to know how to get the best image out of them or whatever effect or whatever it is that you're trying to get out of that piece of equipment and that tool or lights. But you know, you just got to forget about them and use them as a creative storytelling tool. Because really, that's the most important thing is the story. You get a script, you have to be able to tell it in the best way possible. And, you know, we as cinematographers, we use equipment to really help us do all that. So once you master it, yeah, it really helps. And then you get to know kind of, then you have then you know all these pieces of equipment that you can pull from later on when you read something in a script and you're, and it's calling for something in specific, you know, a piece that you used a couple years ago on something might help you achieve and tell that story better. So it can only help you like that.
All right. So I just want to ask you real quick. This is something we're trying to do in, you know, in future episodes of Go Creative Show. And it's just kind of a fun little thing to see what people say. But if you had to pick one piece of gear that you have, it could be big or small, doesn't matter what it is. But what is the one piece of gear that you have to have with you on every shoot?
Got to have your light meters. And I have to carry my my True ND filters, my Mitomo True ND filters. And of course, you have to have a camera and lenses that you can really rely on.
Child's Play, the 2019 version, is coming out on June 21st, 2019. We're all super excited to see it. And thank you so much for coming on to talk about it. You know, it's always great to hear professionals talk about their craft, and you certainly are that. And we thank you for, you know, all the information you gave us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
What's next for you?
The next few things are a few little commercials, and then I'm off to New York to do a show in August. So I'm around LA until then doing some spots.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's nice to have some LA time and some New York time, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be good.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on. And where can people find you online to learn more about you?
I have Instagram, and they can check that out. I have a website as well. Just my name, just BrennanEGama.com. But Instagram is probably the best way. I post stuff all the time. I post images from movies and shows or behind the scenes set shots often. So
yeah, your Instagram is great. It's a great follow. Anybody listening to this show would certainly love it. So I'll put a link to it in the show notes so you guys can get to it easy. But Brandon, thank you so much for being on, and we'll have to have you back for your next project.
Sounds great.
I want to thank Brendan Ugama for coming on the show and talking about his experience and teaching all of us from his experience. That's really what we are all about here at Go Creative Show, teaching people, learning by hearing others talk about their craft and their experience. Isn't that what it is? It's like a mentorship. This show is like a mentorship. Look at that. Of course, I also want to thank Matt Russell for mixing and mastering, making the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com or on Twitter at gainstructure. You can also find us on Twitter. One thing we've been doing is when we have upcoming guests, we mention it on Instagram and Twitter, and we ask the audience for their questions. So if you're not following us there, do, because then your questions can end up on the show. And oftentimes they're better than mine. I also want to thank our sponsors, Hedge.video, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, and Premium Beat. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please support those that support us. We'll see you next time.